From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. So, let's just dive right in.
Yeah, and obviously the overriding news over the last couple of weeks, and I must apologize for not being available last week, Don, I'm sorry. The most important news, of course, is the terrible results of the hurricanes, and in Mexico, the earthquake that has caused so much suffering to what seems like millions of people.
Yeah.
And the current situation in Puerto Rico is really symbolic of so much that's wrong with Latin America and the neo-colonial relationship that prevails between much of Latin America and the Caribbean and the former colonial powers, in particular the United States. And of course, in Puerto Rico's case, you're talking about a country that most of Latin America regards as still being a colony.
Yes, not even a neo-colonial relationship. It's the good old, you know, old-fashioned style.
Yes, I'm here. I know everybody's been very concerned about the indifference with which most of the U.S. Authorities have responded to the situation in Puerto Rico, although and some officials have shown some level of sensitivity. They don't seem to have the power of decision to meet the needs of the people in Puerto Rico. And here in Nicaragua, people have a strong attachment to Puerto Rico because of when Roberto Clemente died, the great Puerto Rican baseball player. And he died in an air accident, bringing relief supplies to people in Managua after the 1972 quake.
Yep, that's right.
And so here people are extremely concerned about what is happening in Puerto Rico, I think the government has already expressed solidarity with the authorities there. But anyway, we just have to hope that the U.S. authorities come to their senses and actually start doing the right thing.
Yeah, you know, part of the problem that exists is the complete looting of Puerto Rico. That's really been an ongoing project since 1898. But you know, that was certainly exemplified last year with the you know, the financial crisis that faced the island nation. You know, the huge pile of debt. And you know, I always get puzzled when you look at public institutions that suddenly have massive debt, and you look to see what assets there are that, you know, were acquired with the funds that created this debt, and there's nothing but, you know, a black hole there. Right. And this is a situation with Puerto Rico. The infrastructure, for example, to deliver aid is one of the failings because the roads haven't been maintained. You know, so the money that was being borrowed from Wall Street, quote unquote, that, you know, the people of Puerto Rico have to pay back, quote unquote, as if they had gotten any of it, did not go to building roads. And we know it didn't go to building housing or schools or electrical infrastructure or water or sewer or whatever. Right. So, because all of these things are failing and have failed already in many respects. And one of the complaints coming out of Washington is, well, we can get the stuff there, but we can't get it distributed because we can't get it out into the, you know, into beyond the airport or beyond the town center or whatever. And that is, you know, the result of it being the place being plundered for, you know, for generations, but certainly for the last 30-40 years.
As Southern Command doesn't have, right, you know, how many battalions of helicopters available?
Yeah, they could drop bombs in every house there probably, right?
Right.
But not loaves of bread, though.
So, yes, yeah, so look, I looked at from a Latin American perspective, Latin American and Caribbean perspective. Puerto Rico is symptomatic of what happens whenever a right-wing government takes power in the region. Mm. And if you look at the situation in Argentina, in Brazil, in Honduras, Guatemala, any of these countries, and when a right-wing government gets into power, they set about extracting whatever wealth they can from the economy for their political backers, including in a very important sense, corporate interests in the United States and the government of the United States. And then what inevitably happens is that there's a strong pushback from ordinary people. And the history of the first, from the late 90s right up until the recent the coup in Brazil, the election result in Argentina, for example, all through that period, the history of Latin America and the Caribbean has been the majority of impoverished people in the region pushing back in some sense or other to achieve a decent life or get access to the resources that will give them a decent life.
Yep.
And that what is happening now is that there's a continuing struggle between that impulse of that huge popular impulse by the impoverished majority in the region and the repressive, deceitful, corrupt response of the region's right-wing elites. And if you look at going back to the disastrous situation in Puerto Rico, and if you compare what's happened in Puerto Rico with what's happened in Cuba, and it's the obvious comparison to make, but even also with Dominica, and to some extent also in the Dominican Republic, but in all of those countries, you have, in particular in Cuba, of course, you have governments that focus more on the human person, on the needs of the human person, and not on corporate needs. And in particular in Cuba, and they've restored electricity, whereas in Puerto Rico they still haven't restored electricity.
Right.
And after Maria. And Cuba was very badly hit after Irma. And people predicted it would take months for them to get back to normal.
Right.
And they're by no means back to normal, but at least they've got the basics in place to get back to normal. You know? And so that obviously, if you look at that in a regional context, and it gives you a good idea of why the impoverished majority throughout Latin America and the Caribbean opt for progressive and even revolutionary alternatives.
Yep.
And so then, and you can see this also in Mexico, of course, because the areas that are impoverished in Mexico were the ones that have been the principal victims of the massive earthquake that Mexico suffered.
Right.
And that's true in the marginal barrios on the outskirts of Mexico City. It's true in the impoverished areas of Chiapas and Oaxaca.
Mm.
And so that, and the government's response, while it hasn't been completely inept, has been by no means convincing, and there were many reports in which people said that it was ordinary grassroots organizing by the people themselves that helped them overcome the immediate worst effects of the earthquake and carry out most of the rescue.
Well, this is also the distinguishing feature, say, between society in Puerto Rico and society in Cuba, or society in Mexico and society in Cuba. The you know, people in Cuba are used to helping each other out when there's a problem. They're trained in these kinds of things, as a matter of fact, as a community, as a neighborhood. You've got the Committees for the Defense of the Revolution that are essentially the self-government organs of, you know, if something happens, the neighborhood knows what to do. And they just set about doing it. The societies in the other places are atomized. It's the opposite of that kind of, you know, on the ground solidarity. And so people look at each other in an entirely different way, and not necessarily in a way that's beneficial. And that's part of the problem. The problem is that this is encouraged. It's not the nature of the people, but rather the nature of the society that, you know, does this to people.
Yeah, and then sticking with the idea of the nature of the society and the where. It's so interesting for anybody that's been following Latin America for several decades, and to see how the response has changed, how the U.S.-backed right-wing elite response has changed. You know, they'll still use repression, as we can see in the outrageous case of Argentina, where you have two very symbolic cases. One of Santiago Maldonado, the activist who was disappeared by the Argentinian security forces, and that's there's no doubt that that's what happened because of all the evidence that's emerged since the events of July 31st, August 1st. And also you have the case of Milagro Salas, a member of the Mercosur parliament, who's been in jail now for 2 years without the accusation made against her being substantially proven. And the accusations against her are absurd in the first place, and that she's was responsible for conspiracy and mutiny and some charge very specific to Argentinian law. But she's very clearly the victim of repression led by the local governor of the province, Jujuy, where she's based, and he seems to be working in league with the local courts to apply sanctions against her. For example, the latest example of this is that Milagro was given house arrest about 3 weeks ago, and that house arrest has now been rescinded on entirely arbitrary grounds. So, you know, that, and those two cases indicate that the regional right wing has by no means abandoned its predisposition to use repression if it can, and it would prefer to, but where it can't do that, it sets up this matrix of media attack, institutional abuse of a country's institutions, and working in league with, I'd argue, corrupt judiciary, but I'm certainly right-wing judiciary, that operate certainly against what most people would regard as an acceptable rule of law. And so you get these situations in Brazil, for example, where Dilma Rousseff is deposed, in Paraguay, where the former president there, I've forgotten his name for the moment, was deposed back, when was it, 2013?
Earlier, I think, but God, yeah.
Right. Yeah, so and on all these, both those instances involved direct intervention by the local U.S. ambassador, who's now a woman whose name I also forget, who's now the head of, she's the civil head of Southern Command Civil Affairs.
Right.
So you have very clear U.S. intervention working with local elites to game their resources in the local judicial, political, and media systems. And in most of these countries, the media has taken on the role, and Attilio Barón, an Argentinian academic, has written quite cogently about this. The media have taken on the role of being the main political party, because the right-wing political parties find it so difficult to mobilize sufficient majority support. So, and you can see this in action also, for example, around the motif of corruption, which was used in the case of Dilma Rousseff, and has been used in the case, for example, of Jorge Glass in Ecuador, the vice president there, who's the victim of what seems to be completely unfounded accusations of corruption that has provoked a deep crisis within the ruling political party, Alianza País. But more dramatically, in Guatemala, once again, as we've mentioned in the past, we have a situation where people are out in the streets calling for the resignation of the president. And that is backed by a campaign led by the United Nations Commission Against Impunity and Corruption in Guatemala, which is run from the outside, very much under the control of the United States. And however much one may dislike or reject the politics of Jimmy Morales, the president, and it's another example of how not anti-democratic forces take control of the public life of a country, of the political life of a country, and decide who is eligible to participate and who is not.
Right.
And in a more important continental sense, one can see this in very, very importantly in Brazil, where Lula da Silva is streets ahead in the opinion polls in terms of approval of potential presidential candidates for next year's presidential elections. But he runs a very serious risk of not being able to take part in those elections because he's subject to bogus corruption charges.
Right. Well, it's, you know, it's interesting because they also went after Dilma, and she was when Lugo was removed from office, and that was in June of 2012, I checked. When he was removed in Paraguay, Dilma Rousseff was the one that stepped up and said, you know, this was an illegal coup, and let's sanction Paraguay at Mercosur and other places. She was the most outspoken defender.
Right.
And they did essentially the same thing to her shortly thereafter. So,
Something that is probably worth noting that we haven't mentioned over the last couple of conversations is that recently the Israeli President Benjamin Netanyahu did a tour of the region, the first tour by an Israeli leader. He visited Argentina, predictably, because Argentina has the biggest Jewish population outside Israel, as I understand it. And he also visited other right-wing leaders, Juan Manuel Santos in Colombia and Peña Nieto in Mexico. And the object of his visit was to gather support for Israel within the in for this upcoming session in the United Nations that's now in progress in the General Assembly.
Yeah.
But it's worth taking note of that because and. My reading of that is that it's yet another sign of the desperation of the regional right wing and also the desperation of Israel in terms of what's happening in its region. Perhaps we should keep an eye on that for future reference about because Israel has had a long relationship in particular with Colombia.
Right.
And I see Netanyahu's visit very much related in that sense, specifically his visit to Colombia, to the situation in Venezuela.
Well, it may also be that he's looking for a new residence in case he decides he must live outside of the jurisdiction, depending on how his own corruption cases go in Israel.
So, and isn't that ironic?
Yep.
Anyway, there are elections coming up in the region here. There are the regional elections in Venezuela, which look as though they're going to vindicate the Venezuelan government led by President Nicolas Maduro. And I think it's 23 governorships that are coming up for election in these October 15th elections, which have been brought forward largely in response to a request by the Venezuelan opposition themselves. Now, the Venezuelan opposition were involved. They're all over the place in terms of the image that they're trying to project to people in Venezuela. On the one hand, they want to project themselves as having now rejected the period of violence in which they provoked and managed all through the months of April to July. In the run-up to the elections for Venezuela's Constituent Assembly. They're trying to project themselves as having overcome that stage and accepting a political solution. But that runs in complete contradiction to the current policy of the United States, which is to accept anything except a political solution. And the United States is still pushing for some way of overthrowing the government of President Nicolas Maduro that doesn't involve elections because they know they're not going to win.
Well, you know, you ought to see the polls that they have posted, though. It's Hercon. They have a poll that was with the data from August 20th to 29th. It says that the opposition has 53.8% and the Great Patriotic Poll 19.3%.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but the nitty-gritty is that they, in line with that disarray on their part, first they said that they would continue in talks with the government in the Dominican Republic about how to reach a negotiated settlement of their differences. And now they've said, or some elements have said, because the Venezuelan opposition is divided into dozens, it seems, of little splinter groups, and that kind of unite around their desire to get rid of Maduro as the country's president, but they can agree on very little else. Yeah. And they all detest each other. So when you see a headline saying Venezuelan opposition in talks with the government, what that means is that some fraction or other, or some ad hoc group that has united around a decision to enter talks with the government has taken that decision.
Right.
But it by no means reflects the position of the overall Venezuelan opposition. And that's why over the last few days, the Venezuelan opposition have said that they're going to back out of the talks in the Dominican Republic, that they don't want the talks. Yes. Because they're hostage to what they did between April and July. And their hardline base rejects toward the government.
Right.
Because their hardline base is directed by the United States.
Yeah.
So you have, and it's a bit like the situation in Syria, where you have this nebulous, supposedly moderate opposition that's impossible to identify. Mm. That have a very strong relationship. And to some extent, their actions are dictated by the extremists who want violent overthrow of the government. Yeah. And the Venezuelan opposition is very much in that situation.
Yeah.
However, the President Maduro, they recently confirmed that they're assigning 70% of the country's budget to social spending. And that's the activity of the National Constituent Assembly has had a tremendous stabilizing effect on the internal situation in Venezuela, despite every effort by the Trump administration, the United States government, to apply sanctions to make it impossible for the Venezuelan government to operate.
Right.
But so far, they seem to have failed in that endeavor.
Yep. Yeah, that's been an ongoing project since the coup in 2002 also. And then when Maduro took office after the passing of Hugo Chavez, the Obama administration really started cranking it up. They were pushing, ended up declaring, which Trump recertified, declaring Venezuela a threat to U.S. national security. And
right.
You know, it's been an ongoing campaign. You also have the, you mentioned the similarities between the right wing and, Al Qaeda types. You even had the, right wing smashing a helicopter into the Constitutional Court.
Right. So then, and the situation in Venezuela seems pretty stable in relative terms compared to what it was, certainly compared to what it was in July. And it looks as though the government is going to do very well in these governmental elections coming up on October the 15th. And looking elsewhere, there are elections coming up in Nicaragua. We have our municipal elections on, I think it's November the 5th. And the government is very likely to do very well, certainly retaining the 111 or so municipalities which it currently controls. Mm. Likely it may even gain some more. It's unlikely to lose any, but we all know how unpredictable politics can be.
But they did very well last year, though. The government did very well in last year's election. So.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And again, one has to remember that here, President Daniel Ortega and his vice president, who's his wife Rosario Murillo, enjoy a popularity and approval ratings of around 80%. Depending on which poll you read, I mean, even the Cid Gallup poll, which is a Costa Rican company, with a decided anti-government bias. Even they acknowledge the massive popularity of Daniel Ortega and Rosario Murillo. So there's likely to be very little change at the municipal government level here in Nicaragua after those elections. Other elections, very important elections in Chile, the presidential elections are happening. I think they're at the end of November, I'm not sure. I have to check that. Hang on a minute. Let me see if I can check that. The Chilean elections are on, let's see, Sunday the 19th of November. Mm-hmm. And there, if there's a second round, there'll be a second round in December sometime. So in those elections, the likely winner looks as though it's going to be the former right-wing president, Sebastián Piñera, who he wasn't eligible to stand in the last election, but he's eligible now. The party of the current president, Michelle Bachelet, looks as though it's split, and that means that they're unlikely to be able to get a majority against Piñera, but I mean, so much depends on what happens in the second round. It's very unlikely that Sebastián Piñera will get an outright majority on the first round. If it goes to the second round, Alejandro Guillier, who's the candidate of Michelle Bachelet's political alliance, he may be able to just scrape a victory against Sebastián Piñera.
Right.
And the main left-wing candidate of the Frente Amplio is a woman called Beatriz Sánchez. And she's likely to do very well, but she's very unlikely to get to the second round. So there we can look forward to probably business as usual in Chile over the next 4 years after that presidential election. Because although domestically there are significant differences between Sebastián Piñera's party and the party of Alejandro Guillier, at an international regional level, their policies are very similar. And then the other elections that we're going to see, and I think they're at the end of October, are the legislative elections in Argentina, which are going to elect a large part of the Senate and the lower house in the country's legislature. And it looks as though, and the way things are shaping up there may be a much stronger rebuff to the government of Mauricio Macri than one might have expected even a couple of weeks ago, because feeling against the Macri government as a result of the forced disappearance of Santiago Maldonado and as a result of the outrageous treatment of Milagros Sala, and as a result of his own corruption, because he's caught up in corruption as well.
Oh, yeah.
Very real corruption.
Yep.
And the inability of his government to deliver on their phony electoral promises made back in 2015, in particular in terms of economic prosperity, control of inflation, financial stability, and all those things. And Macri has basically completely failed to deliver.
You know, it's pretty cute. There's an irony there, too. You know, we have discussed a number of times how nebulous the promises were that Macri made. Basically, we're going to make it better. The economy's going to be better. You're going to be better off, without very many specifics. But one thing people are acutely aware of is that things are not better. And so there's no need to go down a laundry list of, well, he did implement this thing and it didn't work, or he did this, that, or the other policy thing that he promised, but rather, he said he'd make it better, and it's not, and it's a pretty easy calculus for people. So I think it backfired. It may well backfire.
Yeah, from the point of view of the right wing, and when they make these electoral gains, or when they get into power as a result of the skullduggery manipulating the issue of corruption, for example, in Brazil, what they do is they go full tilt to impose their agenda, regardless of what they may have said in the electoral campaign, right? And so what you've got in Argentina has been a really serious rollback of the gains made under the previous administrations of Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner and her deceased husband, Nestor, Nestor Kirchner.
And that rollback is felt by millions of people, and they vote. And we're going to have to pick it up there, Tony. Thank you very much. We'll speak with you again next week, and it's a pleasure, as always.
Okay. Thanks a million, John.
Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.